I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Rick Antonsen joins me again. He has just published a remarkable book, Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea, Crossing the Kokoda Trail in the Last Wild Place on Earth. It is an engrossing adventure that he writes about, one that he takes along a narrow 60-mile footpath through some rough jungle. It is also a charming story in how it all comes about. He meets Monk in Australia, where Rick has recently moved to, as his wife has taken up work there. Monk suggests Rick join him, and soon they're off onto the Kokoda Trail, where some of the fiercest fighting during the Second World War took place. The Australians, Japanese, and Americans fought there, and along this sometimes punishing journey, Rick describes what he sees and what he feels about war, sacrifice, and remembrance. It's often very powerful in this book, where Rick talks about walking the path of history. It's also treacherous. It's not an easy walk with elevation changes and the terrain. I'll get Rick to reflect on what draws people to Papua New Guinea and what attracts the fascination of most of us who'd never think to go there. It's steeped in mystery and danger, not to mention myth and outright distortion. Rick Antonsen is the author of books Full Moon Over Noah's Ark, Route 66 Still Kicks, and To Timbuktu for a Haircut, which he's all joined me for. He's also co-written books with Brian Antonsen, Whistle Posts West, and Slumax Gold, books I've had conversations with Rick about two over the years. He first appeared on the program in 2008 with To Timbuktu for a Haircut, when he was still president and CEO of Tourism Vancouver. He's also been past chair of Destination International and deputy chair of the Pacific Asia Travel Association. This new book is published by Skyhorse. The Twitter handle is at InkRoadsRick. He joined me from Vernon, British Columbia last week. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Rick Antonsen. Mr. Antonsen, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed every other time we've talked about books, and I think I've enjoyed it because you tend to ask some unusual questions, and that keeps me on my toes. So thanks for talking about my new book.
Well, you're very kind. I was just looking it up. I guess the first book, the Timbuktu book, that came out, when, 12 years ago or so?
Yeah, it did. It came out in 2008, and that was To Timbuktu for a Haircut.
Yeah.
And then Route 66 Still Kicks came out around 2012. And then Full Moon Over Mount Ararat came out in 2016. Mm-hmm. And in around that, you did interviews with my brother Brian and me,
right,
about the books that we co-authored with Mary Trainer.
Yeah.
One of those was Whistle Post West, about all the railway stories in Western Canada. And the other, of course, Slumax Gold on the Lost Pit Lake Gold Mine.
Yeah. And not to patronize you, but your books in particular, for the Timbuktu, Ararat, Route 66, and then now this, your growth as a writer, it really comes through in this book. And I mean, those previous books, there are parts of those books that I enjoyed a great deal, stuff that I still think about. But in this book, I mean, do you feel like that you've grown as a writer? I mean, I can't possibly think why one couldn't think that they've grown, having done it, you know, multiple times, say.
That's one of those questions that I think doesn't get asked enough of an author, because, to be honest, a writer should want each of their books, each new book, to be better than the last. It could be, it's like having four children. You love them each in different ways, and you see abilities or strengths in each. So my Mount Ararat book, I think, has probably the most in-depth research, in part because it was in the Middle East, and part because of the turmoil, but also so many, like 1,000 years of recorded history. So Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea has with it a lot of research, but the research is much of it is about 1942, when the horrible battles were happening, and MacArthur called it green hell and said it was the worst fighting conditions anywhere in World War II. So the ability to research is in dealing with, you know, not that long ago history, and I think my writing ability is to bring it alive a little bit better. I think I've gotten good at that. The other thing I will say is that on some of my earlier books, I wasn't sure until well after the trip if I might be writing about it, whereas with the Papua New Guinea book, I kept better notes when I was on my travels. I made mm-hmm. sure there were more photographs taken by my mate Monk so that I could have access to them to jog my memory. So I think in that way, I've become a more mature travel writer, and that I get more while I'm away on the trail, which I think lets me write more vividly when I've returned.
That's the thing that I was wondering about as I was reading the book, is how do you remember so much? And because there's a moment in the book where you get quite ill,
yeah.
and you describe what that's like. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. well, you know, if I was that sick, I'd probably be worried about, you know what I mean? I wouldn't be thinking about things like that. But so do you take notes, say, on a pen and pad, or how does that work?
I do. I take. I've always been a note writer. You know, I'm talking with you now, and I'm just making notes on the side of a piece of paper. When, for example, I was on Route 66, Peter, my travel buddy, had no idea I was writing about the book until we were back 8 months, and I told him. But he would always see me writing notes, but I might write it on the morning newspaper mm. in a small town, a local newspaper, because I just did that. And then at night I might make some other notes when I was alone in my room. So on the Papuan trip, I would make notes around the campfire at night, just because that's what I do. But I think I'm blessed with a good memory, but I would record on with pen on paper snippets of conversation. Then, of course, when you return, you can research much more, which mm. informs the eventual dialogue you attribute to that experience, because someone may have said something about a firefly. Once I've researched it, it's easier for me to explain to the reader the firefly they're holding in their hand, what's happening, because I would have a proper name for the insect. I would know that the male or the female, how they attracted one another. So that informs the vignette, and that would come from research after the fact based on the sort of sketchy notes I have.
Yeah. So the book begins as you join your wife in Australia because she's there for work. How long after you got there did you meet Monk and his wife?
Well, Janice accepted the position. She was general manager with the airport in Cairns, in Queensland, so tropical, and just a beautiful setting. That was a five-year posting. So uh-huh. I was back and forth a bit, and then I left my role with Tourism Vancouver so I could write full-time. So then I essentially moved to Australia, and that was great. But it was about a couple of months after she'd taken the job, and she was there 5 years. So a couple months after that, our neighbors, Glenn and Wens, short for Wendy, uh-huh. the very first night they came over, that's when we met them. That's when he told me his nickname was Monk. So for the rest of the book, he is known as Monk. And it was that evening, after, you know, 4 or 5 hours together, take out pizza, we're drinking beer and stuff. And towards the end, he says to me, "I'm going to do the Kokoda. Uh-huh. Do you want to come?" And I think maybe with the liquid courage I had by that time, I reach out, I shake hands, I say, "Absolutely." And then I look at him, and he's got a bit of a smirk, and I said, "What's the Kokoda?" And he said, "It's a walk across a country." And I said, "Great. What country?" And he says, "Papua New Guinea." Well, at this point, I'm all in. I've made the commitment. I'm embarrassed to say I had not heard about the Kokoda Trail, uh-huh. or as they call it in Australia, the Kokoda Track, that's about 60 miles across some of the most rugged terrain. And indeed, we ended up on a walk across a narrow part of Papua New Guinea. We did walk across the country, but it was grueling, and in fact, they demand that you be in very good shape, because 1 year they had 4 people die, two of them in the same week, all of them much younger than me.
Right, right. So the image that we have of Papua New Guinea, I mean, in our minds, it's beautiful, it's mysterious, but there's a lot that's also not positive, and you write in the book about what's responsible for that misrepresentation. I mean, a lot of the movies, a lot of the poetry even, a lot of the literature has to do with the cannibalism and headhunting and the sort. So, I mean, people must have told you as soon as you agreed with to go on this with Monk that you probably shouldn't do this. Was there a lot of that said?
There was. Something has happened, though, related to the Kokoda Trail in the last maybe 15 years. For Australians, the Gallipoli defines to them sort of a pivotal time in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
The Kokoda Trail, the Kokoda Track, is absolutely fundamental to the Australians' experience around World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't get as much of a national momentum for them for the longest time. And in the early 2000s, there may have been a couple of hundred people that would do this amazing trek each year. Now there could be a couple of thousand or more that take it as a pilgrimage. It's one of the world's top 5 or 10 treks in terms of the demand, the geography, the difficulty, the danger, all of that. But 95% of the people who do it are Australians. Part of that is the location.
Mm.
Papua New Guinea is about a two-hour flight north of Cairns. During the World War II, for Canadians or Americans or Europeans, the battles going on there were sort of called war at the end of the world. For Australians, it was war on our doorstep. But it's a long way for people to go. So the island of New Guinea is about, as I say, a two-hour flight north of Cairns, Australia, and it is the second largest island in the world after Greenland. Half of that island, the western half of New Guinea, is the country of Papua New Guinea. The eastern half of the island of New Guinea is actually the two provinces of the country of Indonesia. So we were in Papua New Guinea. This is where Amelia Earhart was last seen alive,
right,
when she flew out of the city of Leh, never to be seen again. New Guinea is where Michael Rockefeller, son of the at the time governor of New York,
mm-hmm,
went missing and drowned and was thought to have been taken captive by headhunters and suffered from the cannibalism, killed and cannibalized. So there is that deep mystery of a geographically beautiful country.
And you mentioned a moment ago that to do it, I mean, you have to be physically in shape. You can't just decide on a Saturday that you're going to start this thing. What are some of the things that you and Monk have to do to get into shape, to get prepared?
Well, you have to go with an organized group because you travel through a lot of tribal properties or indigenous lands. There are many, many little pockets of peoples. And in fact, in the world today, there are 4,500 living languages, English, French, all sorts of minor ones. Out of the 4,500 living languages, 812 of them are in Papua New Guinea,
mm,
which is an astonishing way to realize how many individual valley tribes or hilltop tribes or plateau tribes there are that for centuries had their own languages. So we are trekking through this area. The guides that we went with sent us a 3-month training program of what they expected us to do in order to be there. So in the final 3 weeks before the trip, they expected Monk and me to be out at least 3 times a week hiking uphill,
uh-huh,
for 3 hours each of those experiences. So they set that. They need a doctor's certificate no more than 30 days out of your departure, saying the doctor tells them your heart is fit, and they demand to see an insurance policy, travel insurance policy, that covers helicoptering you out from the middle of nowhere, New Guinea,
mm,
if you have an accident, knowing that if something happened to you, they might have to carry you 3-4 miles or more,
yeah,
to get to somewhere a helicopter could rescue you from.
What are the people like there? And I'm not just talking about the porters and the people that are part of this organization, say, that brings people in. But the people that you encountered in Papua New Guinea, what are they like?
I would say one of the most striking memories I have from the people of Papua New Guinea is their singing. They seem to think that it's like breathing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're in a village, they may be cleaning up and they will be singing. The porters, who are all Papuans, they would sing first thing in the morning when they're getting the cooking fire going, or they're helping prepare the meals. They would sing on the trail, and they would sing at night when they're getting ready for bed, after we've all tuckered out and just collapsed into our beds. But in villages, the children quite often would gather around where we were having our meal and would sing for us, or they would be playing a game and they would be singing. They have lovely voices. The Papuan national anthem isn't well known. I had never heard it before because it's not on the sports podiums internationally. It's just not something you see at events often. But when they sing it, it's one of the most beautiful national tributes I've ever heard.
And the food, what was that like along the trail?
Well, the food we mostly had to carry in, so it was the freeze-dried type. And the reason was explained to us that if they have some chickens, they don't have enough chickens in a village to feed the trekkers and then have them for what they need, for the laying of eggs or for whatever, for the locals. We would get local fruit, perhaps pineapple or coconut or mango or whatever they had that they would maybe have. In abundance, we could get some of the greens that could be used for a salad that would be plentiful. But if there was a hog, it was probably a wild hog that they wanted to get away, or they would have shot it, but it wouldn't be there for us. So we took along whether it was the powdered soups or whatever. We didn't have a lot of fresh meat until at the very end of the trip, when we got closer to the water, we would have freshly caught fish and a wider variety of fruits. One occasion we did have barbecued chicken and some barbecued pork. Yeah. But otherwise, we were sustaining ourselves on what we brought along, and it was a lot of rice and so forth. But you wanted to try and get your carbs up, the carbohydrates up, because you're just burning through them.
And Spam was something that you ate a lot. Did you do so? What is it like now for you? I mean, can you still eat it, or?
Yeah, I look at it every time I'm in a grocery store. It's just one of those things I now gravitate towards. But I hadn't really had Spam since I was a kid. But there it was, because it was easy to pack. You'd be getting your protein, and you know, two times a day, sometimes three times a day, Spam would be on the menu, and you got used to waking up to the smell of it being grilled and hoping there were some, you know, chunks of cheese you could spread with it. And Janice, my wife, had packed for me and Monk, lots of spices and hot sauces or different things we just had in our pack. And we would sprinkle those around, and then others would borrow them to sprinkle them on just to enliven the rice or enliven the Spam. But Monk called it Kokoda pate. and so we had that, and I will tell you that once we were back in Cairns, a few days later, the first time I saw Monk, I took him over a can of Spam.
He is a real character in the book, Monk is, and there's a fascinating relationship between him and his father that plays out through the book, which I was going to ask you about, but I think people should read because it's fascinating in and of itself. But
good of you to say.
If you had to describe him, how would you? I mean, he comes across as gregarious and just fun to be around. Is he?
Yeah, all the time. He's got sort of an infectious way about him that isn't that he laughs so you laugh, but he's just a storyteller. One thing about the Aussies, you know, if you see a movie that's got a Brit in it, or an American, or a Canadian, or a Chinese person, or whatever, that there's kind of stereotypes in movies.
Yeah.
But the Aussies, they're as advertised. They just show up. If they're in a movie, you recognize them as an Australian neighbor or friend. So Monk's got that. He almost always had a not on Kokoda because we didn't have any alcohol along with us. But, you know, if you're at his home or you're out for dinner or whatever, he's, you know, always got a cold beer at hand.
Yeah.
And it enables his storytelling. But he's got a twist on everything. So, like, when we were training, going up this mountain, and I'm out of breath, I would just ask Monk a question. And he was in such good shape, he could talk all the way up our training mountain. And then we'd get back down, and he'd want to go for beer and chips. And he'd always have things. If I said, gosh, I found out this about World War II, he would have a story that amplified that and made it more engaging. So I tried to import a lot of those stories so that the reader got them in Monk's voice. And when he talked about his dad, and I agree with you, it should be left for the readers to read Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea, and they get all of that out of him. But if he had passion, it was in his eyes. If he had hurt, it was in his eyes. A couple of times on the trail, we stopped for little ceremonies, like on Brigade Hill, where there'd been a terrible battle. And in war, there's a victor, but there's no winners. Everybody's losers. And
right.
Whether it was the Japanese or the Australians, the stories just wrenched your gut. And Monk would give the ode, and he would be asked to do this. And he did it in such a caring voice, but it was like I'd never heard anyone else sort of infuse We Shall Remember Them with such heartfelt, gut-wrenching, tear emotive, and it was just the way he used his words. So he's and loyal.
Yeah.
I mean, he was there, and he was loyal to his porter because he struck up a friendship. He was loyal to everybody, and he was, I think, the emotional linchpin on our journey.
Yeah, there's a moment in the as you're all starting this, because I guess you were all sold on the idea that this would be you and him, and then a very small group.
Yeah,
and then it turns out that it's a much larger group.
Yes,
that concerned you obviously, because you know that's not what you expected. But then what did he tell you when you say complained about that?
He told me to get over it, and part of it was we went to a cemetery, the Bomana Cemetery, where a lot of the Australians who had died in the battle in 1942. And which is buried on the trail. All of those remains were brought back and buried. And one of the things that struck me walking by the grave markers was that there were dozens and dozens and dozens of them, that the only saying on it was, "Known only unto God." They didn't know who the remains were. So any bit I had about being alone took on a whole new connotation when you understood true loneliness, people who had died alone, and they were like, the ages were like 18 or 19. And so when I said to Monk, I was kind of whinging about, you know, now we've got all these other people, he said, just get over it. And in fact, I can't think of one of the people along with us that I would have eliminated from the trek.
Right.
We ended up with, instead of maybe six of us, there were 19. But they were individually so important. And two of the women were nurses. Well, on a place where people die because of heart attacks, having a nurse along or somebody slips you, you're going up, down, up, down, and sometimes you're going down something that feels near vertical, and there's water running down beside you, and you're slipping in mud and grabbing onto roots, and people are cutting themselves. That whole sense of danger was eased some by having along these 19 mates, all Australian, and they all had their own stories or their own secrets that came out, and I think that gave me a much better book to write, because it would be some of them that raised cannibalism, or one of them that talked about being worried about headhunting, and that opened up a narrative opportunity for me in the book to pick up on, remind me of their conversation, and inform it with some research I could do so I got the facts right.
What is it like, Rick, when you're walking through some of these places and resting, where soldiers have died. I mean, that must give you a perspective about war that you couldn't get anywhere else, say.
Yeah, you know, you had a really, really good emotion there, because if you visit war sites, say, in another part of Canada, yeah, from War of 1812, or you visit in Europe where the battles were, they've all been curated, and they get attention from Moeen and all sorts of things, and they've become sites for visitors. And they're totally different than what those was happening in those towns in those times. Whereas here, you're looking at 17 shades of green, the jungles all around you, the pits where people hid and fought from, or the tunneling they did, they're still there. So you're looking at a site with rusted hand grenades around it, helmets that have been broken because they were hit by a bullet. That's all there. It's all still laying about. So you have a sense of what it was then. But I'll tell you, I did a presentation the other day to a group who had asked me to talk about the book. And I told them that a few days before, I wanted to read to them a bit about Brigade Hill, which was one of the worst battles for both sides. Lots of dead Japanese, lots of dead Australians, horrible conditions. These are people who, you know, carved a little foxhole with their helmet, but it was filled up with rain because it constant raining and mugginess. But I thought, I'll read to this group the two pages I wrote about being at Brigade Hill and how I felt and that little service that we had there. And I'm sitting in front of my fireplace at home with a cup of coffee in the morning. Just, I want to read this aloud so that I can prepare for my presentation. And I got a quarter of the way into it, and I realized I was crying.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'll do this. I'll do this later. And so 2 days later, I picked it up, and I thought, I better practice my reading. And I got halfway through it, and I had tears running down my face. I was there. I wrote what I'm reading. And I thought, I can't read this in front of people because I will cry. And I knew I would make them cry. So I told them, go to page 152, and you can read about this, but read it for yourself and when you're alone, because you want to let yourself cry, because the sadness, if that's even, that's almost too simple of a word, but the combination of horror, unexpected, the assault, somebody running at you with a bayonet, all of that becomes alive. And these are the people dying and the people killing. They were somebody's son. They were somebody's brother. They were somebody's dad. They were somebody's grandson. And it's so vivid, and I try to create that for the reader, that you're moved, and you're utterly thankful you weren't one of them.
Yeah, that's one of the more affecting parts of the book. When you talk about war, you talk about sacrifice, and I mean, you described a moment ago, Monk, and as you're paying tribute along the way, the reader can't help but say, I don't know if change their mind about war, but it certainly makes you think about, you know, you read the news and you're always hearing, yeah, about someone wanting to go to war about this, that, or the other.
Right.
I don't know, going there must, I mean, if you're reading it, let alone going there, it must change, you know.
Well, it makes you realize that when you look at the situation, say, with America and Iran now, you just have to hold your hand up and shout, diplomacy, diplomacy. You know, the moment you start sending troops in to kill one another and tell them they've got to hate one another because that'll make it easier to kill them. But, you know, if they were neighbors, they'd be barbecuing together, or they would be going on walks together. Or I go to my grandson's soccer game in Port Moody. It's like watching the United Nations play the United Nations. That's just our neighborhoods. And if he goes to a sleepover at a friend's, maybe the place smells like Indian food, or if it's another friend, it might smell like Korean food, or if it's another friend, it might smell like Iranian food.
Yeah.
This is us where it works, where the experiment works. But in war, each side tells each other that the other people are to be hated and to be killed. So you're right. It either reinforced or changed my absolute belief that until you have exhausted 99% of every possible diplomatic limits. Until you've exhausted that, nobody should die. Yeah. Nobody needs to die.
Yeah. This is obviously a physical journey for you as you're going through this, but as you write in the book, it's also a spiritual one. Well, were there things that you learned about yourself that you didn't know before?
Let me tell you one. I'll try and tell this succinctly because this really bothered me. Each night, sort of with a little warning, one of our two guides would say, hey, Monk or Jim or whatever, recap our day. Now, everybody knew what the day was, so one of us would just say a little bit about how we were feeling, or do you remember going up the wall, or gosh, I thought I was out of breath, or whatever. But they just sort of do a little recap around the campfire after dinner. We're drinking hot chocolate. And one day, halfway through, the guide said, Rick, you talk. And before I really could edit myself or censor myself or whatever, I was talking about how much hate or bewilderment or disgust I was feeling about the enemy. Mm-hmm. I'm traveling, trekking with a bunch of exhausted Aussies. We're looking at it through the eyes of Australians mostly. So you begin to incorporate this everywhere you go. You just don't like the people that were killing your mates, killing the grandparents of the mates I was with, whatever. And I said, I find that very difficult because I couldn't reconcile it. Hating the Japanese of 1942, hate might be as being disgusted with the Japanese of 1942. I couldn't reconcile that with, I've been to Japan 12, 15 times.
Yeah.
I have dear friends from Japan of many ages. I worked in the tourism industry, and when I traveled there, I would travel with Japanese friends or Japanese colleagues. I've been to Ground Zero of Hiroshima, and I stood there beside Japanese friends, and neither of us could reconcile what we were feeling there about what had happened. And I've been in the homes of Japanese friends. I've had countless meals with them. I love them. I love the Japanese people, the Japanese culture, Japanese literature, Japanese music, and my Japanese friends. Yet on Kokoda at that time around the campfire, what I was sharing with my Australian mates was, there's something in me that is just disgusted. And when I write the first draft of my books, I have some friends that I really trust as early readers,
mm-hmm.
Who are absolutely candid with me. And one of them said, Rick, the way you wrote that, you sound a bit racist. And he said, I've known you for 20 years. I've worked with you. You're not racist, but you're sounding racist. And this fellow had taught English in Japan for 3 years. His wife is Japanese. And he really helped me keep the emotion, but try and refine the way I portrayed it in my writing. Mm-hmm. And I sent him several redrafts because he said, I can see and understand the emotion, but the way you're explaining it, you're maybe looking through racist lenses. And so he helped me. So I think the explanation in the book is much more honest,
mm-hmm.
because he helped me stand back and be objective about the gut feeling without demeaning another race,
yeah.
which was not my intention. So he had helped me deal with the emotion, not with the race. And I really appreciate that. So it's a long answer, but that's one of the things perhaps I learned the most.
Yeah, it's gaining that, you have to get away from it almost to understand what you're feeling and get the perspective that you need to understand what you're feeling, you saw, you know. There's so much in the book that I enjoyed in terms of just your writing and your ability to take these moments of your travels and weave them with history and the sort.
Thank you.
I complained on Facebook the other day that too much time passes between these books of yours.
I mean,
It's been about 4 years since the previous one?
Full Moon Over Noah's Ark came out in 2016. This came out in 2019. But I do have a new book that will come out in 2020 in September.
Well, there
and
you go.
I hope you will have me back and we can talk about it. And it's closer to home and it's not as adventuresome. But I have to say that to your earlier point that your observation would be that, so my writing improves with each book. My storytelling. I would say that my next book that comes out in September 2020 is my best book, my best written book, and in many ways has more of me in the telling, being able to be honest about a lot of things, because I travel by I was on the Rocky Mountaineer train for an extended trip with my grandson Riley, who was 10 years old, and I learned so much through his eyes, like I learned through monk's eyes when I was in Papua New Guinea. I learned in Alberta and British Columbia and the Canadian Rockies. I learned from my grandson, Riley.
I got to write this down. September 2020, you're back on.
September 2020, and the book is called Train Beyond the Mountains.
Yeah.
And the subtitle is Journeys on the Rocky Mountaineer. And it'll be published by Greystone Publishing, which is one of Canada's best book publishing companies for sure. And it's a really neat book, and people will get to know Riley, and through him, through all the passengers. It's such an inspiring landscape, and the fellow passengers talk to us about the days of steam train and some of the other international trains to go on, and so it's a one of the narrative threads is about the world of train travel, of which Rocky Mountaineer is a very, very important. It's the most spectacular train in the world.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. I'm a big train fan, so this will be fun for me to...
Oh, yay. I will make sure you see a copy early.
Absolutely, yeah. Back to walking with ghosts in Papua New Guinea. What is Monk thought of the book?
Well, Monk's... and you'll get this about him in the book. He's quite unassuming, and he's not someone who would see himself as a hero character or a main character in a book. And I would send him stuff just to validate it, or say, in this vignette, I'm talking about how much you really, really dislike your father, who had abandoned you as a young kid. All of that, I, when I would send him some stuff, he'd be, "I'm okay about this." And if we talked on Skype, he'd say, "Yeah, I'm okay." But him having the book in his hands, it's quite different. He wouldn't have expected to see his photograph at the very front of my acknowledgments section.
Uh-huh.
He never on the trip saw himself as kind of a linchpin for all of us truckers. But if when one reads the book, if there's a consistent element, it would be Monk's sort of his levity when the rest of us are just absolutely struggling on a part of the getting our boots sucked down by the mud, or going across a dangerous river crossing on slippery windfall logs. Monk would have a levity. He would set up with his camera saying, "I want to get a picture of one of you falling in," when everybody knew that he was down there because if somebody fell in and needed help, he'd be there to have their back. That's the type of heat, but he would never say, "I'm here because I got your back if you fall in." He'd say, "I want to get a picture of you falling in." Nobody fell in, but Monk would find a way for that levity. So I do know he's surprised that to find himself as sort of a continuity in the narrative.
Uh-huh.
He would never say he's proud of that. He would never say thank you for doing that. He would just say, "We made it, mate.
Yeah.
We made it."
Yeah.
Nice, huh?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, there's a wonderful lesson also in the book where you talk about planning for trips. Planning for adventures, and that you can overplan these things, and I think that's something that affects a lot of us.
Yeah, I agree with your point, because if you pre-plan, you get rid of the aha moment, and it's like if you go to Paris and you just see you know, the 12 things somebody else told you you should see when you go to Paris. What you miss is walking down a side street, feeling a bit lost, finding a small tucked away cafe with seven seats and having one of the most marvelous meals you've ever had and some neat wine that you never would have discovered otherwise. So the being over prepared, I think it was Paul Theroux who said, tourists don't remember what they've seen, travelers don't know where they're going, something like that. I'm paraphrasing probably improperly, but it's to keep that traveler gene in you of discovery of, you might know the name of seven villages, but you're surprised to find which one we camped in that night, or you're surprised at the singing kids, or when you see some of their local art, you knew there was great art there, but you didn't go looking for a mask, and then you find this mask that you can't buy because there's only one of them, and it's not for sale. You want to keep those things, because that's what keeps you on your traveler's toes.
Yeah.
And I do think it is easy to plan the element of surprise right out of your journey, and that's not good. I like getting lost. I like the surprises, but you don't want to be so ill prepared that if you're lost, you don't have the survival kit with you, or you don't have the compass, or you're out of shout of where your guide is, and you're not going to. You don't want to put yourself in harm's way. Yeah. You want to put yourself in the way of certain neat surprises.
Rick, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. Congratulations on this book. I could talk all day with you about it.
Thanks.
It's a fine achievement, and I hope a lot of people pick it up because, as I said off the top, your skill as a writer, I mean, it's born through these pages. Nice to talk again. Hope you're well.
Very good to talk with you, and thanks so much for having me on.
The book is called Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea, Crossing the Kokoda Trail in the Last Wild Place on Earth. It is published by Skyhorse, and its author Rick Antonsen joined me on the line from Vernon, British Columbia. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.